Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our Vatican Weekend English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, The Pope and the People. We have a report on Pope Francis's general audience, where he announces the convening of a pre-synodal meeting in March to listen to the voices, doubts and criticisms of young people from across the world. Protecting children online. We learn more about growing international cooperation to combat the abuse and exploitation of minors online at a congress hosted by a pontifical university. Facing up to fake news. With the Pope wanting the Church to tackle the growing issue of fake news, we reflect on this phenomenon and how Christians should respond to it. And echoes from Vatican II. We step back in time to the opening of the Second Vatican Council in October 1962 and hear from an eyewitness about the excitement surrounding that historic event. We begin our programme with a report on Pope Francis's Wednesday general audience, where he announced the convening of a pre-synodal meeting in March to listen to the voices, doubts and criticisms of young people from across the world. Lidio Kane reports.
Cui sono invitati giovani provenienti dalle diverse parti del mondo.
It was towards the end of the general audience on Wednesday that Pope Francis issued an open invitation to the youth of the world, young Catholics and young people from different Christian denominations and other religions, as well as non-believers, to participate in a pre-synodal meeting organised by the General Secretariat of the Synod of Bishops. He said that this initiative, to be held next March the 19th to the 24th, was part of the preparations for the next General Assembly of the Synod of Bishops, which will be on youth, faith and vocation discernment in October 2018. With this journey, the Pope continued, the Church wants to listen to the voice, the sensitivity of faith and also the doubts and criticisms of young people. As has become customary during the audience, Pope Francis continued his catechesis on Christian hope. This week, the Holy Father turned his attention to the Christian's calling to be a missionary of hope. As an example, he chose a great saint of the Church and his own namesake, Saint Francis, whose feast day is celebrated on October the 4th, calling him a true missionary of the joyful hope born of Christ's victory over death. He went on to say that Jesus asks us to be witnesses of that same hope, confident in the transforming power of his Spirit at work in our hearts and in our world. Joy, the Pope underlined, is the sure sign of true Christian hope, but he also noted that there are times when the gift of hope proves costly.
Pensiamo a tanti cristiani che non hanno abbandonato il loro popolo quando è venuto il tempo della persecuzione.
The Holy Father was referring to fellow Christians who presently experience persecution and all the martyrs down through the centuries. He said that their witness inspires us to continue to hope in Christ's promises. Behold, the true Christian is this, said Pope Francis, not complacent and angry, but convinced by the strength of the resurrection. Concluding his audience, the Holy Father greeted all the English-speaking pilgrims present, and in words to visitors from Egypt, the Pope prayed that the Lord would bless them, protect their country, the Middle East and the whole world from all evil and terrorism. I'm Lydia O'Kane.
How to combat abuse and exploitation of children online was the subject of a World Congress held in Rome this last week entitled Child Dignity in the Digital World. The four-day meeting was hosted by the Pontifical Gregorian University and brought together different government and police representatives, software companies, religious leaders and medical experts specialised in the impact of online abuse. Among those who addressed the Congress was the Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, who described the abuse of children online as one of today's most important and urgent issues, and said the Church's efforts to protect children in our digitalized world must be expanded and deepened. The meeting concluded with a joint action plan that was presented to Pope Francis during an audience with him on Friday, October the 6th. Among the main organisers of the event was Baroness Johanna Shields, the British government's special representative on internet crime and founder of a global alliance called We Protect. She talked to Philippa Hitchin about the growing urgency of this worldwide problem.
Well, when I was at Facebook, David Cameron came to me. I brought Mark Zuckerberg to meet David Cameron. And he came to us with this problem of children being groomed online for sexual abuse and exploitation. And there were some very high-profile, heartbreaking cases in the UK. April Jones and her family, what they suffered at the hands of a pedophile who had accessed child sexual abuse imagery and then gone on to commit a heinous crime. So when Mark was there, he brought us together and said, you really have to do something about this crime that's happening on your network.
This was a number of years ago, wasn't it? What progress do you feel that you've made since then?
This was in 2010, and while I was leading Facebook in Europe, Middle East, and Africa, we started working hand in hand with CEOP, you know, the Child Online Protection Center in the UK, with the FBI, with the US Justice Department, and it became clear that this is a cross-border crime and a cross-border problem. So David Cameron contacted President Obama, and they set up a technology task force and a task force to address this issue. So when the two countries that came together decided that we needed something much stronger, so we formed an organization. I formed an organization called We Protect. And what We Protect is the hands-on, multi-stakeholder approach to challenging this crime globally. So we have law enforcement, governments, over 70 governments currently. We have NGOs and all the technology companies all working together to, you know, share information, identify challenges and problems, you know, prosecute criminals cross-border and bring them to justice and protect victims.
It's a huge, huge task, isn't it? And as you well know, as fast as you find solutions, there are people out there trying to find new ways of reaching young, vulnerable people.
You're absolutely correct. The challenge with this is technology is evolving and morphing at such a pace. And when you think about it, you have over 3 billion people connected on the planet. So, you know, the complexity is, you know, orders of magnitude beyond what, you know, you anticipate, and it changes every day. So we absolutely have to stay on this. And part of the reasons we're here in Rome at the Pontifical Gregorian University is to bring together world experts now to not only have a chance to have the We Protect Coalition come together, which we are all here in force, but also to bring academics to look at how this is impacting the psychology of young people, the physiology, you know, their mental health and well-being. So we are bringing together leading academics to ask them to share and collaborate and work together on building a response to this problem on the ground in their communities.
As you say, this conference here in Rome is looking at, obviously, cyber security, but it's a much more holistic approach, as you say. What specific role are you looking for, or what specific role do you think the Church can play in this field?
Well, this generation that's growing up now, they were post-millennium, they've grown up completely connected to smartphones and social media. So this is a very different dimension. Now, there's been some research recently about how these young people, they go out less. They're advancing into adulthood slower than previous generations because everything's at their fingertips. So what we need to do is, in order to relate to them and understand their unique problems and challenges, we have to look at how they use these products, the risks and harms that can happen, you know, deeply look at those problems, the risks and harms that can happen, and how we can support them to be healthy, happy adults, which is, I think, why the Church is so interested in ensuring that this generation is protected.
What specific contribution, what are you looking for from church leaders, if you like, or local people in the parishes? How can they really help to tackle this problem at a local level?
Well, I think when you, I'll play a video shortly, and when you see the video, you can feel, the harm that's being done to young people, and they need support and solutions to recover and to, you know, be more digitally resilient and have the confidence to go back into the world after they have something happen to them. And the church has to play a major role in that. So this conference looks at two things. One is how children develop the confidence and the digital literacy to react to what they're exposed to in this amazing, knowledge superhighway. But they also, we have to look at what is being done to children and the impact on their mental health, their physical health, and what we need to do about it. I think the church, the faith community in general, the church and all faiths need to understand what's happening to young people and build a credible response that supports them and takes them into this, we've been going warp speed into an unknown world. And some people call it the greatest social experiment in history, this internet, enabled world. And we have to get this right, because there are developments in technology that are going to take this, as I said, orders of magnitude beyond where we are today. We have artificial intelligence, we have, augmented realities, and these are big issues. And we need to understand this, embrace it, and be able to support the next generation as they live their lives through screens and connected to the internet and all the services it provides.
That was Baroness Johanna Shield, the British government's special representative on internet crime, interviewed by Philippa Hitchin. Pope Francis will focus on the harmful effects of fake news in his message for the Church's World Communications Day in May 2018. Its theme is "The Truth Will Set You Free: Fake News and Journalism for Peace." A Vatican statement said the Church too wants to contribute to a reflection on the causes, the logic and the consequences of disinformation in the media, and help promote professional journalism that always seeks the truth and promotes understanding between people. Polls show growing concern among the public over the phenomenon of fake news that has proliferated, especially online and on social media. The term fake news is now a common catchphrase. But what exactly is fake news? Where does it come from? And as Christians, how can we respond to this phenomenon? Well, to find some answers to those questions, I sat down with Monsignor John Kennedy, a senior official at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, who's been researching and reflecting on this issue.
This phrase, maybe I'm mistaken, but this phrase is kind of on everybody's lips. We're talking about fake news. So my question has been, where does fake news come from?
And where does it come from?
Well, sometimes we're not altogether sure. I was out cutting my grass last week and I noticed that some weeds had cropped up, but I wasn't sure where they came from either. And I think that's a little bit like fake news. However, what I do know is that fake news, like the weeds in my garden, it's there. And maybe it's not going away. So maybe when we're talking about fake news today, we have other questions to ask as well, like who's making fake news?
Who's spreading it?
Who's spreading it? And what impact is it having on our lives?
And where does the term fake news come from? You've been doing some research, I know.
Well, as you said, I was doing some research and I began to dig into the notion of fake news. So I started with the word fake. So the word fake, as we know, means not genuine, counterfeit or imitation. I'll give you an example, a fake passport in a James Bond movie, for example. So I went to the dictionary and it says that the word fake comes from the late 18th century, from a slang term whose provenance is unknown. So I suppose what I'm thinking here is that if you're going to sum up what we've said in one point, you could say really that fake news or hoax news or any other term you really want to use as well, it's just news that is not true. So without putting...
It's a lie.
Well, without putting too fine a point on it, it is a lie.
So really what you're saying is that fake news is not exactly a new phenomenon, as many might think, and comes to mind a little that phrase from the Bible, that there's nothing new under the sun. This has been going on for a long time.
This has been going on, and I don't think it's going to stop anytime soon. But I wonder if we thought about fake news in this way, I wonder, would it change our perception of our willingness to listen to it? Let me give you an example. Let's say you're in the supermarket and you need some detergent to wash your clothes. So you see a couple of products on the shelf, and the first one is the one that you always choose because it's guaranteed and it works and so on. And then you have one beside it which has a label around the top saying fake detergent. And then as you read down through the details and the description, it says this is unreliable, this doesn't work, and this will absolutely waste your money. You probably won't buy it.
No, definitely not.
Okay. Now, the problem here with fake news is that it doesn't always appear so clearly as fake news.
But sometimes we do know, don't we, that fake news is not genuine, or we have that suspicion.
We can sort of use our nose to sort of sniff out, is it so fantastical to be true? But sometimes there could be a doubt, and sometimes we actually end up maybe even sharing this kind of story or this event with other people as well. But the other side of fake news is that there's a part of us that's always curious. And even if it sounds strange or colourful or interesting, you know, it's our ears tend to prick up and we do want to listen to it. I think the difficulty here is that we don't often have the time, and we sometimes don't have the resources to actually do the background check to see is it actually true. And I'm not trying to cast any kind of shadows here, but sometimes fake news comes to us from media sources that might not be as reliable as, say, traditional media sources. In other words, you might read it on a screen, maybe.
Or a dodgy social media website or something.
You could, whereas in the traditional news, you have the person reading the news and you have their face and you have the script and you have the images to sort of back up. And it's backed up by reporters and it's kind of verified. Whereas sometimes with fake news, it's not verified and it's actually not verifiable by you.
And I suppose what makes it rather alluring is that it's sometimes more colourful, even more interesting sometimes than regular news. It piques our attention.
Well, you know, if you look at a regular news broadcast, very often at the end of the segment, there's a story about a happy incident or somebody whose luck has turned positive or something. And that little news story tends to sweeten all of the difficult and violent and sorrowful stories that have preceded it. So in some ways, maybe fake news latches on to that desire in our minds and in our hearts that we have, that we're looking for good news.
Just how damaging, though, can fake news be?
It can be very damaging. I don't know whether we have actually a measurement to actually give us a reading or a percentage or something. But what can be very damaging about it is once it's out there, it can be very difficult to correct it, and it could be almost impossible to remove it. You know the way if you put up things on a website, I think they're generally there forever, and it's pretty hard to actually get them off.
So it continues to have an influence then?
Oh, for sure. And if a person's reputation is at stake, it might be very difficult for that person to get their good name back. And I suppose what we can say is that fake news can have a negative impact and negative ramifications. You know, in some ways, they say that you don't get a second chance to make a first impression. And, you know, you can do all the corrections you want and you can publish all the corrective articles that you need to. But sometimes when it's out there, it becomes part of the public lore. And people said, oh, I heard that once. And they didn't ever go back to it. Because
it sticks in their mind. It's more enduring.
Yeah, and then some other news story came along and took its place. But it's still there in some ways.
For our listeners who might be wondering, what is the true and correct Christian response to this phenomenon? How can the scriptures and our faith help us to navigate better in the face of this reality?
There's a beautiful line in the psalm, and it's, "Your word is a light for my path." And so in the scriptures, if you look for any references that deal with the question of fake or something which is deceitful or false, you're going to find quite a few. The first one that jumped out at me was St. Paul writing to the Corinthians. It's in 2 Corinthians chapter 11. And Paul here is speaking about a situation in the early church where there were some leaders, figures who were leading the community, who weren't being truthful. He says, "For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of the light. So it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness."
So coming back to the task of Christians, how should we deal with or tackle this phenomenon of fake news?
I would say initially this is not an easy task to do, but this is a modern day challenge that Christians will now have to face. In short, what I could say is that we have to realise we have a choice about what we hear and about what we do. And for that reason, we should maybe listen a little bit more. And we should then try and listen carefully and filter out what seems to be true and what seems to be untrue, and then act on what we know is right. The words that we use ourselves also have to be truthful. What we could do actually is, if we heard an item of fake news, we can actually stop it going any further by, if you like, binning it in our own lives and not allowing it to spread.
And especially not sharing it, say, with our friends on Facebook, like many people might do.
There's a temptation, you know, to forward or to send to all your friends in your group. But if you figure, no, this is actually not a good story. And if I were the person in this story and somebody else were spreading it about me, I wouldn't feel too comfortable. So to use that sort of gauge.
Let's talk now about the specific role of the gospel. I mean, we've been talking here about fake or bad news, but of course the gospel is all about the good news.
Well, you know, you've hit the nail on the head. This is a timely reminder, while talking about one thing, to actually refer to something else. And the gospel is about good news. The gospel is actually all good news. It's good news from the beginning right to the very end. What we can say about Christ the Lord is that he never, ever promoted any fake news. His words were always truthful and always life-giving. He didn't distract people. His words were used to build people up, to people allow people to grow in faith. And so that way he never deceived us. He says, "I am the way, the truth, and the life." And because he is the truth, he becomes for us not only the source of truth, but also the measurement of veracity. And maybe if we think about it this way, we can see that the gospel will help us to come to know the truth and to embrace it and to allow it to have an effect on our lives.
Who brings good news?
And thanks there to Monsignor John Kennedy from the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith for sharing his thoughts with us on that issue. Fifty-five years ago this week, the Second Vatican Council was officially inaugurated. But what was the mood and expectations surrounding that momentous event? Keep listening, and you can find out from an eyewitness. Participants and observers alike said there was a real sense that history was being made. That was the widespread feeling among those who took part or who closely followed the deliberations of the Second Vatican Council that opened on October the 11th, 1962, after almost 3 years of preparation.
Hic ad beati Petri sepulchrum concilium ecumenicum Vaticanum secundum Solemniter initium capit.
Pope John the 23rd surprised many when he had first announced that he was convening the council, saying there was a need to update and transform the church. The council lasted from 1962 to 1965 and produced 16 landmark documents. These documents modernized the liturgy, renewed the priesthood and religious life, enhanced the role of lay Catholics, opened dialogue with other churches and non-Christians, and identified the church as the people of God, attuned to the problems and hopes of the world. But what were the feelings of the young seminarians and priests who were studying in Rome or elsewhere at the time of the Second Vatican Council? One of those was Patrick Kelly, now Archbishop Emeritus of Liverpool. He was a postgraduate theology student in Rome when the Council began its work and was present in St. Peter's Basilica for the opening session. He begins by recalling the prelude to the Council and how the first inkling of what was to follow came when Pope John XXIII was elected to the papacy.
Well, I think we've got to go back a bit. We've got to go back to the excitement on the night that Pope John XXIII was elected. I remember it very well. I was in St. Peter's Square, and oddly enough, I've just had sent back to me a letter I wrote 2 days later to a priest in England. And among other things, I just happened to note in that letter, when the name John was given, there was a huge cheer, bigger than when they gave the cardinal's name. And I put in the letter, "Is this the first of many surprises?" That same night, I spoke with Monsignor William Hurd, who later became a cardinal, and he said to me that night, "This man knows what he wants, and he will get it." That, I think, is part of the picture. And therefore, I think when he announced in the sacristy of St. Paul's that he was going to call a general council, I thought, is this what is meant by he knows what he wants and he will get it? So there's that preparatory story. And then, of course, the opening itself. I was in St. Peter's, masquerading, if you like, as the secretary of my bishop, who, of course, was present. And my memory is of coming back to the college and saying to my fellow students, that opening address by the Holy Father was something I've not heard before. There was a tone of optimism, a tone of clarity, and a declaration that what wanted to be heard was good news. He actually, at that occasion, talked about the prophets of gloom and doom with whom he didn't agree because history did not bear them out.
And when that first document from the Council was promulgated that paved the way for the celebration of the Mass in the vernacular, what was your personal reaction and that of your fellow students in Rome?
Well, what is so wonderful is the day it was actually submitted to the final vote, I had the flu. I remember it very well. I remember listening to the radio. Very rarely were we allowed radios, but I was to hear this. And the first thing I thought, and I still remember, is when the vote was cast, there was a spontaneous outburst of applause, and I felt I was back with those daring words from the Acts of the Apostles, "To seem good to the Holy Spirit and to us." Here was teaching confidence with assurance, not due to our merits, but because of the presence of the Holy Spirit.
Now, as we all know, not everybody in the church saw the council as a positive thing, and some Catholics claim that the changes and reforms were not interpreted or implemented correctly afterwards. What's your feeling on this?
I think it would be very hard after any council for implementation always to go smoothly. Again, that, like Pope John XXIII insisted, know your history. So after some councils, it took decades before the implications of the council were completely understood and the right balances were achieved. But it always seemed to me on certain pivotal questions there was absolute clarity. For example, when it came to the liturgy, that the liturgy must communicate to those who take part. The problem is some people confuse communication almost with banality. But then we see the importance of symbols and poetry in the liturgy, because symbols and poetry communicate at a deeper level. And I think, and this may above all be true of the English-speaking world, because from the beginning when we had translations, since I'd had the possibility of learning other languages like Italian and French and some Spanish, I could see that some of our English versions were very thin compared with the richness of other languages, and that one day we'd need to have to revisit these things.
And that was the Archbishop Emeritus of Liverpool, Patrick Kelly. And that's all we have time for on today's programme. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.